This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to New York, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Good evening, everyone. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here we believe when the people speak, they make a difference, or they make poetry. Tonight we're going to have a special show. I'm going to be reading some of my poetry and some of my favorite poetry from friends and people that I have grown to love and understand deeply through their work, through their poems. As far as, my own work, some people, some of the questions asked were like, what kind of methods do people use when they're writing? I think for everybody it's a little bit different. So tonight I've decided to talk about writing, passion, joy, pain. As a writer, many times I find it very difficult to write. I fall victim to the same set of rules that people all over the world find themselves subject to. Life seems to always be in the way. I find myself feeling guilty about following my dream, always having to steal time from time to pursue my passion and my love of words. This piece of poetry came from one of those moments. Thief. Thief. Guilty is charged. Guilty of stealing time from time. Time. Such slipping beats of something, of nothing, of all. Needing to have you, just and only. I have no choice. Slipping my hand into your purse, finding it empty of clocks. Moments hiding in the lining. A game of seeking ensues. Talents rip the cloth and reach through to grab my hand that I may reach the poetry. Guilty of not wanting to do all the things that interferes with the tears in the lining. Coins sounding like seconds ticking away, days. Stop the clock that I may reach into the purse and find the poetry. Then there are times when I just can't find any words at all. There I would sit on my endless nights, blankly searching. On those nights I would write just to fill the paper. One night I decided to write of the paper, but the paper was too empty. Paper is so easy to change, to fit whatever we want it to be. A friend of mine sent me a poem recently, and I responded to her poem. The poem she sent me was called Paper Eye by Carl Sandburg, one of my favorite poets. It reads, paper is two kind, to write on and to wrap with. If you like to write, you write. If you like to wrap, you wrap. Some papers, like writers, some papers, like wrappers. Are you a writer or a rapper? My response to her was, I have been both. Times when I've been a writer, I fill the paper with all I feel. Times I've been a rapper, I wear the paper, wrapped around me as a blanket or a shroud. I so love the paper. So that's how it works. You never know what's going to come out. poetry is... just the most fascinating genre of writing, I think, I can experience. What ends up happening is that it becomes a friend. You rant to your poetry. You talk to your poetry. Rantings of insanity, and you heard me. I spoke in ranting, a language of my own mind. You answered in verse, a part of my mind. So strange to talk to myself and be talking to you. The workings of my mind, so strange. Yet you understood this language of ranting insanity that brings me to the points of clarity. I talk to me in my mind and I hear the words hidden behind the symbols of my insanity. You translate ranting into words that are clearer to me than any language I've ever known. In my insanity, you found the sane. In my dreams, you found the archetypes. In my scream, you knew I was calling you. In my orgasmic vertigo, you saw what I could not. and in my surrender, you saw me become female, male, animal spirit and soul. You walked through my mind and heard it telling you what I did not know, what I could not hear. You walked into me and dragged the light in your wake. Those are some of the things that people write about. One of the, I'm very proud because I have a little imp of a grandson who has already achieved status in two national anthologies. Noah is my little muse, I think. This is his last piece that just got published in A Celebration of Poets in the spring of 2008. And he wrote Snowflakes. Snowflakes I love. I love snowflakes. I love the way the white snowflake slides off the cushiony soft cloud, then lands perfectly on the sparkling grass that Jack Frost has frozen. Each snowflake has a unique texture. Each one has one-of-a-kind patterns. The small snowflakes move slowly across the frozen air. The fierce wind blows harshly on my numb cheeks. The snow falls in a random pattern, and it looks like a miniature blizzard. The kids scream with joy. That tells me they love the depth of the snow. The city loves winter. Noah Arabo, grade 4, Barnard Elementary. It's amazing how, this is actually his second poem to enter into the national anthology, and out of all of the children across the United States, which is a pretty cool trick. I taught him his trick, but not his poems. His poems are his own. He does a fantastic job. He's an extremely expressionist person. You know, a lot of people say that they can't write poetry. I don't think people understand the nature of what poetry really is. Poetry is no more than an expression of what you feel inside of you, and it doesn't have to be anything more than that. Although there are poets throughout history that have been the Nerudas of the world, the Rumis, the Gibrans, the Shakespearean. It's an amazing, amazing world. And our societies have not only flourished through poetry, but they have nurtured this craft because it is I believe it to be a protected craft. I truly do. I believe it to be a craft that that society embraces, even when they don't want to embrace it. And I'll tell you, because for me, it's how we express the things that are not allowed to be said. The things that are never allowed to be talked about. In many cases, poets of old had secretive writings, and they would express their writing in poems, almost like a map to a secret world, a map to a secret understanding, a map to many of the Sufi poets. Work that way. It was almost as if they had discovered a land of their own, a world of their own. one of the things that I absolutely love to do is to collect poetry from many poets from across the world. And any of my travels, one of the things that I've always done is I have tried to get a book from a local poet. A local female poet. For some reason, I just have a really great appreciation of women poets. And for me, it's the best thing on the planet. One year, I was actually not far from my home. My husband and I have a place up in Traverse City, Michigan, and we went there one year, and just were, you know, at odds with what to do with ourselves. So I looked in the local newspaper, and there was a poetry reading. I had to drag him, kicking and screaming, to go. But it was one of the nicest experiences he'd had in a long time. So we had a lot of fun. But who we met there was a young activist and poet by the name of Esther Posner. Now, Esther is amazing. Her collection of poetry is called The Lost and Found Works of Esther Posner. Esther's mother is a great activist in the cause that is very near and dear to my heart, the Palestinian cause. And both of them at the time had presented this poetry reading in order to help a young Palestinian that was struggling to fight deportation from the United States. And in this, and this was March 31st, and I don't see a year here, but March 31st, and her dedication to me was, "Falastin Arabiya min Ahl al-Mayya lal-Mayya, Salam and Shukran, Esther." Now, what she says here is, Palestine is Arabic, and it's Arabic from the water to the water, from the oceans to the sea. So this was a nice dedication, and I appreciate it. And she wrote, I understand now. You are a revolutionary, and so is everyone in the movement. They get out there and say, back the fuck up, Bush and killers alike. We do not agree with your bullshit plans. You are a psycho, and you're not representing the people of your own fucking nation or whatever the fuck this mistake, this disaster. How dare we study? We sporadically offer Native American literature classes in very liberal colleges. We erase the history. Native American? That's not what they should be called. Yes, they are the natives of America, but how dare we call them Americans? We, and I'm given no choice but to say we, let's see if I can try it in another way. I was supposed to be doing my homework, of course. But instead, I sat on a chair and gazed at him again. He leaned forward towards his books, and I thanked all those thankable good doers that made it so. We'd always be in the library at the same time. Oh, no. I watched his pen flow, dangling, twirling around his hazy red hands. He breathes and leans back into his chair. And I am no more the stalker taking notes on beauty. Everyone's asleep. He makes eye contact with everyone but me. She was she is an extremely talented young woman, and I appreciate her depth of character. She was 18 years old at the time, and here is this young lady, this powerful advocate for Palestine, this powerful activist, writing about things beyond her years, and that's just how poetry works. It's an amazing, amazing genre. Alice Walker, you know, somebody asked me who one of my favorite poems is. Alice Walker is one of mine. And her book, The Blue Body, Everything We Know, is really quite inspiring. I picked this one up in London. And I was there, and I kept asking the young gentleman, I said, no, I need an English poet from the area, a local poet. No, but Alice Walker is great. And we went on and talked about this so many times back and forth. Well, Alice Walker is the author of The Color Purple, for those of you that don't know. But anyway, he kept pushing it on me and pushing it on me. I felt I was compelled to take Alice's book. And I never regretted it because I am a great fan of hers. Perfection. Having reached perfection as you have, there no longer exists the need for love. Love is abolition, and dirtied is due the sinner can cause. And then the girl who died, number one, look, she cried, I'm not perfect, but still your sister. Love me. But the mob beat her and kicked her and shaved her head until she saw exactly how wrong she was. You know, so much of our history lies in poetry. For those of you that didn't get that, that was a poem about racism. Young girls, young sisters thinking that they could actually be sisters in a racist world. That was pretty crazy stuff, I'll tell you. And Alice spoke about all of this a lot in her poetry. She often gave a poetry for this race of people that, for whatever reason, had been. I guess you know what it is. I think it's being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Honestly, I don't know. Can people really hate as much as they do in the world? Can they really hate as much as they do without thinking about it, without knowing what it is that they hate? How can you hate something and you don't even know what it is? But they do, and that, I think, is confusing, and that's why poetry is the only answer. Poetry is the only way you can describe something like that. How else can you describe a young girl laughing and walking and embracing her sister and then having her head being kicked and beaten and having her head shaved bald? It's amazing. There is a dear friend of mine. His name is Dr. Sam Hammond. And Sam is a great mentor of mine. He is a good friend. He's helped me with a lot of projects. And he was at one time the executive director of the mosque in Washington, D.C. And he wrote The Bedouin Dress. You run your hand just so very slowly over the dark sewn fabric of this Bedouin dress. You feel 3,000 years rough up against the color of your skin, against the colors of your memory. You tell me when I wear this dress, I always come out red. And I look at the rustle in you and say, you must look good all red. And the brightness of your hair is lit up by the shine of your eyes. So predictable, a beauty, but your laughter, always surprising and new. Like this dress, so many years in the making, so many hidden desert places, so many deep crevices in the heart. It's, you know, poetry like that, talking about our history again, talking about our ancient Bedouin roots, bringing to people who had never heard about these things before. People who, I don't know. What are you going to say? You're going to tell people that for writing, for some people, it's an escape. I also write to escape, but I always end up here at the paper. I hope I never find the exit sign. I'm not particularly fond of voids. And that night, as I sat staring at the blank white paper, no words came to me. No words came to me. And no words came to me now because I just wiped out the screen. Now that's what you get when you get full of yourself as the writer. I'll have to start that one over in a bit. It's one of my favorite poems. I know that... And here I go, and here it is. And no words came to me. So I decided to paint the paper with black to fill the white that seemed to stare at me with defiance. Looked much better. You see, now all I had to do was uncover the words. If I waited long enough, I was sure they'd appear like the stars in the night sky. They seemed to unfold in the dark. If we start at a place that's full and not empty, we can generally find our way out. For I have found that we humans, like water, seep into the crevices of life, searching for our dreams. It is in the places of busy emptiness that we have difficulty. So often I trip over the nothingness, the blankness that life can hold. It's filled with clutter and nonsensical things, like a room overflowing with bric-a-brac. I look out the windows and see nothing. The dust is thick and coats the glass. I rub the pane of the window that hides from me my dreams, and I let light into this place, this room so full of nothing. Many times life seems distorted, benign, lying like an elephant in the middle of the room. Am I the only one that sees him? Pick up the sofa, and he disappears under it. I'm surprised he fit. The sofa seems suddenly so small, and he's so large. A multicolored quilt lies limp and lifeless upon the arm of the sofa. It must be the lady of the house. Tired. So tired of dusting the endless bric-a-brac. Not to mention the sofa she lifts every day. Too tired to visit with me. Too tired to drag out the elephant. She has just enough strength to lift the sofa and hide the elephant. Least I should see. Least I should know the truth. I sat with the multicolored quilt lying across my legs and looked at the squares that created it. This patch came from her birthing cloth. I can still smell the innocence wafting through the weave, the powdered scent of baby's bottom. Childhood must be this one, with balloons. Looks like a party. And here is the coming of age. Red on white. For you see, such is the way of innocence. From balloons to bloody rites of passage. But to where? For you see, she, this lifeless quilt, left the balloons behind and never returned. Her candles now burn at both ends in this party piece of quilt. Oh, so soft the flowers of the spring that bore her. This lost patch of quilt here, right here. This pink floral patch. A supple swath of dress, long since forgotten. The quilt says tea time. Oh, no, I spilt it. And she hurriedly soaks up the spilled tea with her dusting cloth, drops the cloth filled with tea into the laundry hamper. Strange, I thought. That hamper is where her arms should be. The stitches of the quilt grow thin and fragile, breakable. The patches grow aged and tattered by the winds that blow her willy-nilly, lost to all that seemed to fit so neatly under the sofa. Slipping to the floor, crumpled in a heap, untouched by her weight, I fall into dreams so deep, I'm afraid I'll fall forever. She warns me. She warns me about dreams and how easily they disappear if we let them. But I bury deep into her folds anyway. So deep, I forget it's not me, but the crumpled quilt that lives in this room of endless night. This patch here, the one sewn with black thread. So frightening. It is death. He lies to her and calls himself silk. I know he is the blood. Bloody tears shed from years of hopelessness, of lost passion and unfulfilled dreams, a coverlet of all during the day and during the night covered by patches of a life long gone. Oh, God, yes, there it is along the edges of the quilt. Am I the only one that sees it? There was a fire that once burned. The singed tips of the cloth bear proof, proof that it did exist. Passion, hot, fiery passion, once, long ago. Then she hears it, a voice beckoning to her from the window. Death calls to this patchwork shroud that she has now become. She goes willingly into his world, not even a glance behind her. Passion marches in the funeral procession. Flowered dresses dance at the gravesite. She is free. She is free. I wrote this piece, and I call it The Quilt, in honor of women who have died before they die, women that have lost their passion to time and the bric-a-brac that seems to fill our lives with things that steal our dreams. And I say to all, remember the quilt, find the passion, and follow your dreams. I wrote that a long time ago. And I've read it in a few of the poetry readings, and for some reason it always elicits an interesting response from a lot of women, especially educated women for some reason. I don't understand that, I guess. There are, gosh, I'm sitting here trying to go through some of my books that I have here. Books are wonderful, for those of you that don't know. They hold all of the minds, the souls, the loves, and everything else. This one right here, like flaming fields stroked by a gentle breeze, one woman's sojourn from pain, was actually from a friend that I met on the internet. On this particular program. I haven't seen her in a long time. But it was raw. Sarah Brinklow wrote this. Once again, I find myself wanting to speak to the one I love more than no other, wanting to speak from my heart and my soul, as I thought you knew I had before. I ache and I bleed and I'm raw. I just keep trying to find the right words that will wake you from that sleep that I know will just hurt, want to shake you, but you can't seem to hear me. You don't want me to see. From the sound of it, it seems you no longer feel me. Someone deliver me from this heartache I feel. I bleed and I ache, and goddamn, it's real. So I can't forget us, and I'm raw, our lives separated. So an alien concept to me, my God, this was never supposed to have happened. My heart and mind untwined, intertwined. Seems that you've put me out of your sight, but can you keep me out of your mind? The ache in my head is the ache of my heart. The longing I have that will never, ever be apart. My spirit, it aches, and I'm raw. There are, you know, one time I tried to, let me see if I can get that one. I had gone to a poetry reading. My first time I experienced Suhair Hammad. Suhair is a Palestinian poet. Slash comedian from New York. And the first time I experienced Suhair's work, I just loved the energy that this woman exuded. She and her poetry was almost this like hip hop kind of, and I thought, well, I've never done anything like that. I wonder if I could do that. I wrote Going Postal. Sometimes you have to get into that place, going postal. I suppose one must go postal, fly the skies, post the notes, lick the stamps, nice stamps with love and flowers and Elvis on them, lick the stamps, the bloody stamps, sprinkled and spattered with droplets of postal people parts. Comic relief, unlike barbarians with rags on their heads. No love stamps, just yellow license plates, no flowers, just murdered olive trees. No Elvis, just Kulthum, dressed in black. No comparison to going postal, murder suicides, because we're Western and they're Eastern. And their terrorist killings and ours are just going postal, just like going to the bar, going dancing, or going swimming, you know, just another random act of violence. That was just because a man or a woman screwed my pay scale? Fuck that. I'll just go postal on your ass. Not less, like our us Arabs. Not like sand niggas. We're decent folk. We bathe our children before we drown them so they can look all pretty and such. Or take them for a ride in an old pickup truck. Then wake their kids and make them breakfast and give them their book bag and strap their bombs on their kids every day. Morning of every school day, just in the case they happen to be in the neighborhood and decide not to go out for pizza, but to blow pizza up, you just go postal on your ass. We mamas here, we take good care of our kids. We take them for a ride, and then we bake them real good in 130 degrees while we get our hair did. Not like those Arab mamas who teach their children to kill. We better than that. We nice. They bad. We light. They dark. We better than that. So that was a... That was an interesting little takeoff from my usual genre of writing. I often wonder if anybody ever listens to ranting like that. We did. We loved her ranting. We thought she was magnificent in her ranting. And again, all of it, stories, rants, tales, myths, culture, history brought forth so that it's never lost. Questions. I think part of poetry is and one of its most interesting aspects is its question. You know, you always have a question when you're dealing with poetry. It's like, why are these things happening? I don't know. I've never been able to answer them. God knows I've tried. I read an article about a young man. Oh, let me he was in Palestine, and he had issues with fear and shame surrounding a situation that happened to him. And he wrote that during one of the bombings, he and his family had run to save their lives to hide in safety in one of the olive storage rooms until the bombing was over, the Israeli bombing. And he wrote of his overwhelming feeling of helplessness at the situation that faced him and the thoughts and the moments of hiding. And his greatest sadness was that he had somehow shamed his beloved Palestine. He told of the sickly color of the green tanks that littered the landscape of his homeland and how sad a sight the distorted green weapons of war were to his eyes. After that, I wrote this poem. Buckle your seatbelts. It's got a little length to it. Green, green grasses lying beneath these caves hold only despair. Would they ask us? Oh, I'm sorry. This is, wow, that's not even the one, is it? No, I'm sorry. I really blew that one. I guess I should have been better prepared for my own show. I'm sure there's another one here, but I will have to come back to that one in a little bit. And, you know, we talk about, again, we go back to how do we deal with our own issues? One of the problems that I've always had with war and with the male energies, the masculine energies in the world is, you know, is this phoniness that seems to exist in a lot of the male warriors. And I had heard, you know, I think all of us have probably heard the little quip about men spend 9 months trying to get out of the womb and the rest of their lives trying to get back into the womb. What does this mean in relation to the male and female energies? It is a metaphor of the struggle to get back to the feminine. And when we do this, when we say these things and we hear words of war and words of destruction, words of suffering, words of pain, we somehow attribute that to the feminine energies. But I think men feel that pain as well. It's unfortunate that we have somehow tried to separate each other from what is happening in our world. And here's the poem. Green, green grasses lying in these caves that hold only despair. Would they ask us to kneel in homage to deceit as Satan beguilingly asked of the fuller of destiny? Test you your faith, defying all that we know is true. Sleeping in the hills, a lion at heart, a soldier of innocence, a call of the wild, a garden of gentle winds. We climb the tree, the mountains that once were hills, kissing the leaves of the olive trees with morning dew. Our spirits lie softly upon the soil, and with claws we dig graves for our martyred children. Must we also lie in our waking moments within these graves? Is it not enough to suffer just to live and bury our children? Walking the streets in search of flowers, we find our tortured grasses crushed by the weight of oppression, camouflaged as sickly green tanks, green, green grasses of Palestine. Forced to submission by a mirrored and distorted image of the color green. How can they think this color so dull to our pristine eyes camouflage? Yet it must be, for the world only sees the natural color of stones, and we become the reviled. Paling woefully to the magnificent green of our grassy hills turned mountains, upon our children's bones, obvious, blatant distortions of the green that our martyred children are buried under upon our hills. We pile our dead with the stones that martyred them in homage to their courage. Stone upon stone, laid to their breast, we raise the level of the sea and the mountains grow. Is this a test of faith or a test of humanity? what human creation given by the giver of life could do what has done to the Palestine of our carver's dreams? What holy sanction could uphold such violation of virgin soil? Ravaged innocence, dust and smoke-filled skies, her only cover to those that would shame her, not at the unholy plight befallen her, but shame her of the discourse, shame created by human degradation, shame at the love devoid within the eyes of her rapist. Do I shame her, curled here in the corner of the olive storage room, hiding, tears shed at my own failure to save her from her enemy? No, they shame her by the talons of mechanical claws that rip away the branches of her olive trees and strip her of her glory, leaving her comforted, foolishly thinking she is of the dead. She is not dead. She lives in our hearts. We are the flowers, and our roots grow deep. She is of the living. She is the young lovers that gleaned her fields to lie sweetly entwined in her embrace. Is it our legacy to die, never to stand freely upon her hills, to lie beneath only as fodder for the olives? And if we are to become consummate of her earth, what of we? Oh, what of we? We become part of the trees, kissed by the dew on a soft rainy day. I, the leaf on the right, you, my neighbor, touching each other in solidarity. Shade to our martyrs, lying beneath us, providing the trees of Palestine her sustenance. What a glorious gift they have been given in the becoming of our life's blood of our future generations. No, no victims lie here. Courage and glory are our heritage, written upon the tombstones by the carvers of our faith. Our story, our courage, and our history, that of our land, Palestine. I can't tell you how many ways I have pride in the people that I grew up with, in my heritage. And one of the things that we have understood in our lives is poetry and culture in the Arab world is one. There is no differentiation. Even our language is a very soft, feminine, almost effeminate language, because it has so, it is such a layered language that it's poetry just to speak in Arabic, even if it's something simple. It doesn't even have to be any kind of poetic stance or position. And that's what a lot of people don't understand. I think that's where a lot of confusion comes up when you're talking about, oh, certain things that people say in Palestine. Because it is such a multi-layered language, words can be misconstrued deeply. And that's unfortunate. I wish they could understand how wonderful it is. But, you know, then again, as poets, we become so damn serious. That's the problem, too, that we forget to have fun. So this is one of my favorite poems from an old book that I had gotten called Changing Light, The Eternal Cycle of Night and Day by Ruth Gendler. Ruth is a wonderful poet in and of herself, but this particular one, this particular book was an anthology of many writers, and the writers all wrote about the day and the cycles of the day and the night. Write about a radish. Too many people write about the moon. The night is black, the stars are small and high, the clock unwinds its ever-ticking tune, hills gleam dimly, distant nighthawks cry, and a radish rises in the waiting sun. So you can see that not everybody takes it as seriously as some. These books have been a great comfort to me when I don't know who to talk to, when I don't know what to say. There's always a place that I can turn to and be comforted, a place where I can understand things like being in transit. I am in transit. When I'm running, I'm not here. I'm not yesterday. I am not tomorrow. I am en route, racing. I get back to the same feeling of not being here, the feeling of being a spirit in other realms, the feeling of non-being that frightened me so as a child. No one to bring it into focus. Stopping, I am filled. It is at stop that I am being. Now, these are just different ways of saying live in the now, enjoy your life, don't take yourself so seriously. And poets can take themselves seriously, that I can assure you. We tend to be very forlorn. I always had images of those the beatnik little jazz dens where people would go in. I wanted to grow up and grow. Actually, I have been to a couple of those places, and they're rocking. They're a lot of fun. There's a little place in Garden City here. It's not far from my house, and it's called Maxwell's Treasures. And Maxwell's Treasures is an incredible community of people that come together, and they have these blues and muse nights. When I first walked into it, the first time I was ever introduced to it, I walked in and I says, "This is Garden City," and I laughed because, you know, you would have thought you were walking into some loft museum in Greenwich Village or something, and here is this incredibly eclectic place filled with everything from artwork to a menagerie of artwork to antiques. Matt, Laura's son, the owner of the place, is a metal craftsman, and he takes pieces of metal and makes out of them the most incredible sculptures that you've ever seen. I'm talking like railroad ties and things like that. He's just an unbelievably creative human being. And they get together and they do that kind of snap your finger kind of thing and the blues, and they have an open mic, and we get up there and we mess around a little bit, and it's a lot of fun. It's also a very sad thing. A couple of years ago, there was a gentleman, a friend of ours. He was 24 years old, and he had just graduated from dentistry school, and he had finished his exams and had gone home that night. He lived on his own, but that night he went home to his family's home, excuse me, and he went to bed, and his father wasn't 15 feet away playing cards with some buddies of his, and he never woke up. He had an unknown condition of his heart that nobody had ever diagnosed, and he died that night. And at the funeral, for some reason, that funeral, Malik's death, and Malik, for those of you that don't know any Arabic, means angel or Malak. And when Malik died, for some reason, that was probably one of the most horrific deaths that I'd ever experienced in my life. For some reason, I guess you, as a parent, you figure, hey, my kid's home. This is the safest place in the world for him. You know, you always have that sense of urgency or anxiety when they're out and about and doing all their grown-up things, but they're always your children. When they come home and when they're in your arms and in your home, in the womb of the place that gave them birth, and then they die, you really feel the sense of helplessness and that exists around life. It's such a poignant moment, and I wrote this, and it was I called it The Funeral. His brother cried, the sound like a howl, something primal, deep. So deep it broke hearts. His father's arms limp, helpless, exposed. I could not save you. His sister, lost in the world without a savior. No hero to look to in her hour of most need. His mother, draped on a white coffin, crumpled, like cookie crumbs on a white tablecloth. Malik died 2.5 years ago, and his death has never, for whatever reason, ever left me. And I knew him, but, you know kids, you know their parents more than you know the kids. But he was a wonderful young man, and it was a very powerful experience. So, you know, that's what poetry does. That poetry can take that funeral, that vision, and capture it. It can capture it in something that is that's salvageable, I guess, when all else isn't salvageable. And I think that's the key, that you need to salvage your life. And we don't know how often. There's a good friend of mine, and, you know, often people sit there and say, well, you write about some sad things. And there are sad things that happen in the world. Life is oftentimes sad. According to Khalil Gibran, there is an equal measure of sadness in the world as there is joy. And it is only in direct correlation to the amount of sadness that you experience based on the amount of joy that you've experienced. And I found that to be really helpful for me when people pass. But about a few years ago, my husband's best friend was killed in a tragic car accident. It was an unfortunate accident. He died instantly. Just broke our hearts. This was a man that stood up in our wedding, 41 years ago. And to have him pass like that was just so awful. And we used to be traveling buddies, and his wife was she's a character. She loves Mexico, and she was always flirting with all the Mexican men whenever we went down there. So, I wrote this one day. The guys had given us some money, and me, I need my fingers and my toes to add to five. Excuse me. And so my husband, you know, gave me some money, and I thought, oh, my God, I've got all this money. This is wonderful. I'm going to go shopping. It didn't get us very far, I assure you. Apparently the jerks had really played with us that day, and there we were in the middle of the marketplace. I was ready to send her home with this Mexican guy that really liked her a lot just to get a deal on some pewter. She refused in the end, and we ended up going to a bar, and we looked at each other, and I said, you think we can manage to get a beer or something? So we walked into the bar, and we threw this change on the table, and then we asked, what will this buy us in the hot Mexican bar on a hot Mexican day? What will this buy us, Mr. Hot Mexican Man? Some loose change strewn on a table, all that separates us from the heated sun and dust in our throats, separates us from deep thoughts and secrets that can only be shared in a hazy, sun-filled Mexican bar, dust lingering in the floodlights of sunshine, streaming in old windows, interrupted only by your hair, eyes down as usual, friends lingering over two beers and some loose change, talking about things one can only talk about on a hazy, sun-filled day in Mexico with two beers and some loose change between us. So that was a poem that came from our travels. And you know, this poem came to me probably 5 years after the trip. But it was that memory that never left me of how much fun my friend and I had that day. We were shopping with no money and running around Mexico flirting with all these guys, and our husbands were laughing, thinking they had gotten one over on us. So that's how poetry is, and that's how it works. And then people sit there and say, well, I can't write poetry. Anybody can write poetry. anybody can write poetry. Anybody can sit down and write what their thoughts are, what they're feeling, what they want to hear, what they want people to hear, and what they want nobody to hear. It took me many years to be able to talk about my poetry in public, and a lot longer for me to have any of it published, because God forbid anybody should ever interrupt my flow of creative perfection. We couldn't have that. I really took myself pretty seriously in the beginning, and it was a lot. It was so funny. It was actually kind of humorous when I think back on it, because there we are, these rantings in our lives of why we do things. Why is it important? Why is all this so powerful to us? What is powerful to us? These are our deepest moments, our most angry moments, our moments of love. I have one poem that I wrote that's 91 pages long. It's what you would call an epic bantering of my mind. And how can people do that, I wonder, write for so long? Well, I didn't do it all in one day, and it takes time. I have a poem that, for some reason, it's been used in a number of things. Gentlemen called me, actually two or three people have called me. One woman wanted to use it in a documentary that she was making. She was a filmmaker. Another gentleman from MIT called me one day and asked me if he could use this poem in a work that he was doing, and it was a project for the coming together of a future industrial park on the border between Israel and Palestine. And, you know, I was very honored because he had, I was in there with Noam Chomsky and a few other influential people that I really admire a lot. So for me, it was I was tickled when he asked me to use the poem. And it's still in there. And it's called State of Dreams. And it says, "Now I lay me down to sleep. Sleep, woman, and enter a state of grace. For you see, dreams are of what we are made." Oh, God. My computer is just not working with me today. I apologize. "Here you lie, a forgotten breath, within this place of dreams. I am a nation, or am I but a seeker in the void? Jew or Arab, I am neither, and I am both. What difference to this place that I come to every night? This place I call my own is yours as well. Here in this dream state, the color of your flag is but symbolism in all its splendor. Here, archetypes battle on the fields, and images of who and what we are become confusing kaleidoscope visions within the dreamscape of our nightly journey to this state of grace, this place where I sleep. Therefore, I ask, who is the rightful owner of this country? And in this dark place of the sleeping sun, where does he lay his head? In this country behind the veil of light, we are free to roam at will. In this place of rest, I lay my head. Now I lay me down to sleep. At the beginnings and the endings of the day, I leave in wakefulness the struggles of my life. Here at the doorway tonight, I pull the blanket of sleep over me and awaken to a state of grace." And it's been promoted in a lot of interesting ways. I guess, and, you know, I never really thought much of it when I first wrote it. I thought it was kind of silly, actually. Not the idea, not the concept. I thought the concept was beautiful. But I thought it was kind of almost childlike, and I thought, well, I can do better than that. So I put it off to the side, and one day somebody asked me to submit a poem to some group or another that I had been affiliated with in my constant quest to free my lovely Palestine. And somehow it got out there, and I guess a lot of people like it for some reason. I tried this one. I thought this one was kind of interesting. It's a riddle. What do you call a person who has no forward movement, no backward movement, no sideways movement, no upward movement, no downward movement, no growth, no future, no past, no present? The answer is upside down. A suicide bomber. I will die, or I will die loudly, but I will die. Next riddle. What is war? The answer is upside down. What is war? I don't know. We talk about it and we write about it and archetypes on the battle on the fields. What does that mean? What it really means is that people are dying and we're writing poetry about them because it makes us feel better. But I guess that's what poetry does. It makes us feel better. So the issue with, you know, the other thing too is there are a lot of thoughts that come up when you're writing, and you almost get to the point where, oh wow, well, you almost get to a place where you don't know what to do with it all. So I keep a running dialogue, and it's called Random Lines, and then I go and I go over there. The other thing, and here is my last statement for the night, and I appreciate you all listening. God is nothing. Blame creation. So let's stop blaming God. Let's just blame creation. Put the blame where it deserves. And that's it for the night, folks. Thank you for engaging in my rant and in my raving lunacy and in my poetry and the poetry of my friends and the people that I love in my life. We'll see you next Tuesday night, and we'll be back to our regular show.
This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest.